for Thursday, April 12, 2007. For those who are watching us in person or online, understand that we've got a very long agenda. We're going to have long agendas now, probably for now till the end of the month. And we're going to take it somewhat out of the order in which it's printed. We're going to do public hearings first and be hearing in the following order: House Bill 3445, then 3442, then 3441, then 2190, then 2134, and then, if time permits, go on to do work sessions in the following order: 2913, 2448, and 3119. I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3445. Council Asanich.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 3445 has amendments that should be in your packets. It adds a premises open to the public in service districts to the definition of highway for the purposes of enforcement of the vehicle code.
Very good. And we have Representative Wisnant, sponsor of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnant, State Representative District 53, including Sun River. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3445 today. Is that too many fours? I would appreciate a work session so we could move this important public safety forward today. I'll be very brief and concise. The bill is very important to the permanent residents of Sun River and the thousands of visitors to Sun River every year. Sun River created a service district for law enforcement and fire protection to improve our public safety capabilities in 2002. Then we discovered that our DPSST trained and qualified law enforcement officers could not cite people for speeding, driving without seat belts, and other major traffic violations, basic traffic violations. They could cite drivers for major traffic crimes. The bill was drafted by lawyers representing the service district and Sun River Owners Association. A letter of support for this bill is on your desk from the Deschutes County Commissioners. I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill. With me today to testify and answer any questions are Doug Cedar, Chair of the Service District Board, and Scott Hardtongue, Sun River Homeowners Association Board President. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and honorable committee members.
Mr. Cedar and Mr. Hardtongue, why don't you come forward together?
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Scott Hardtongue, President of the Sun River Owners Association. With me this morning are Doug Cedar, who's Chair of our Service District, and Mike Kennedy, who's Chief of our local police department. Thank you for your time this morning. We'd like to testify in support of House Bill 3445. The Owners Association strongly supports this bill because it allows the Sun River Police to enforce traffic offenses contained in the Oregon Vehicle Code on Sun River roads while preserving Sun River's private ownership and regulation over its roadways. While other communities and commercial areas have private roads that are open to the public, Sun River is unique in that it is a resort and not just a residential community. The fact that Sun River is a major resort creates unique issues that do not arise in typical communities with homeowner associations. Sun River Owners Association needs to retain its rulemaking authority to ensure that Sun River continues to be a great place to live and to visit. Sun River is widely recognized as a premier family destination resort and has a reputation of being a very safe place in which to enjoy outdoor activities. The safety of our owners and visitors is very important to the community, which has supported its own police department since the Owners Association was created in 1973. The community wants full enforcement of the Oregon Vehicle Code on its roads. As of today, over 1,200 residents have signed petitions in support of the bill. We ask you to help ensure the public safety in Sun River at a high level by sending House Bill 3445 to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. That is the conclusion of my testimony. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Hartung. Let's go to the other members of the panel, and then we can take questions for the group.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Cedar. I'm a Sun River resident, and speaking in favor of House Bill 3445-2, and as Scott mentioned, I'm also chair of the Sun River Service District Managing Board. The authority to stop motor vehicles for minor violations of the Oregon Vehicle Code, such as speeding, failure to signal a turn, minor equipment violations, for example, broken taillights, is a major tool of law enforcement in maintaining public safety. Based on the uncertainty of the classification of Sun River roads, the Sun River Police are currently not using that tool. In 2006, the Sun River Police made 3,337 stops for violations of the Oregon Vehicle Code. If Sun River roads are not considered highways, only 1% or 37 of those over 3,000 stops would have been made. And we want to provide the Sun River Police with the authority that they need to ensure that public safety is maintained at the highest possible level for Sun River residents and visitors. And the House Bill 3445-2 accomplishes this objective, and we ask for your support. The Sun River Service District, the Homeowners Association, the Deschutes County District Attorney, the Deschutes County Board of County Commissioners, and Black Butte Ranch all support the bill. And we request that you pass this legislation, you attach an emergency clause so that it goes into effect immediately upon the governor's signature. Now, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Kennedy, did you have any remarks you wanted to make before we open it for questions?
No, sir.
Very good. Committee, you've heard the presentation here, and I draw your attention to the fact that the Dash 2 amendments have the emergency clause that was just suggested. Any questions?
It's only the Dash 2 we're looking at. The Dash 2 replaces the other one.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bonamici.
I have a question, but I'm not sure if it's appropriately addressed to counsel or to the panel. In the Dash 2 amendments, it says, for purposes of enforcing traffic offenses contained in the Oregon Vehicle Code, except for, and then there's an exception in ORS 810-230, and I just wondered what that was. If we're excluding a particular area or...
Actually, Chair Witt and Representative Bonamici, actually, I'm not sure what the 810-230 that I
took off. Unlawful sign display exceptions penalty. So that okay. I'm not sure.
That okay. Mr. Chair,
go ahead,
Representative Bonamici. That was an issue we resolved with ODOT, and they do not oppose the bill.
That's your speed signs.
Is yeah, because we want to have our own standard signs, and ODOT does not oppose that.
They didn't have
a roundabout one.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative.
Any further questions?
Chair McPherson, so does that mean garage sale signs are allowed or not? Oh, okay.
Actually, that is one of the other aspects of that is to allow our present design standards to still be enforced on our roadside signs.
Appropriately.
Very good. If there are no further questions, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3445 and open a work session on House Bill 3445.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2s into House Bill 3445.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 3445. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, the Dash 2 amendments are in the bill.
And I'll, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3445 with the... We have the emergency already in it. Move the fourth to be passed.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3445 as amended by the Dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
The only thing I'd say, I'm surprised. I think the definition of highway would already cover you, but since apparently it doesn't or somebody doesn't think it does, I'm fine with supporting this just to make sure you're doing it right.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure Representative Wisnett had a clause in here to anybody who votes for his bill has immunity when we drive through Sun River.
That would be nice.
You'll have to talk to the chief about that one.
And a place to stay.
$50.
We got to fill those forms out this week. Be careful.
Over $10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If there's no further discussion, then the on the motion, Representative Barker's motion to move House Bill 3445 as amended to the floor with a due pass, call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 3445 moves to the floor as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass. This, Representative Wisnett, do you want to carry it, or shall we entertain a motion to put it on the consent calendar?
I'd be glad to.
Okay, very good. Well, then Representative Wisnett will carry House Bill 3445. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3445 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3442.
I don't think he would. I mean, he is there, but...
Council, could you introduce this bill?
Thank you, Chairman, first members of the committee. House Bill 3442, for the purposes of the Vehicle Code, expands the definition of a police officer to include law enforcement officer employed by county service district.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable committee members, and thank you for your action on the last bill. I bring you today another short and to-the-point bill. We need to add law enforcement officers employed by a county service district established under ORS 451.410 to 451.610 to the definition of police officers definition in ORS 809.395. Sun River Owners Association in 2002 established a service district for law enforcement and fire protection. All Sun River police officers receive full training at DPSST and are fully qualified police officers. With me today is Sun River Police Chief Mike Kennedy, is here to answer any specific questions along with Kevin Campbell. Mr. Chair and committee members, I was asked, but I'm not going to bring it up today, and we can look at it if the bill goes to the Senate, and I think there's some opposition to adding reserve police officers to the bill by the city of Beaverton. You do not have that in front of you today.
Mr. Campbell.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, very simply, the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police support this effort to clarify this in law. We're less supportive with adding the amendments that Representative Wisnett mentioned at this point because there is appears some opposition to that, and those amendments haven't been drafted, as I understand. So I'm not sure that anything's before the committee other than what we're proposing here today, and so with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Chief Mike Kennedy, who can give you the gory details about the bill, but we support their efforts there in Sun River to clarify this.
Chief Kennedy.
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Mike Kennedy. I'm the Chief of Police of the Sun River Police Department. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3442, which will add the Service District Police to the definition of police officer for the purpose of the Oregon Motor Vehicle Code. When ORS 801395 was written, there were no service district police departments in Oregon. Over two decades later, there are two such agencies, Black Butte and Sun River Police Department. The ability of any police officer to enforce traffic laws is an essential tool for keeping the communities we serve safe. Obviously, it directly affects our ability to keep the streets safe. However, it is also a major tool in detecting and deterring criminal activity. As an example, in 2006, 73% of our drug arrests, 70% of our DUI arrests, and 53% of our warrant arrests were made as a result of minor traffic infractions. This bill is extremely important to our agencies as well as the communities we serve. I respectfully ask for your support in the passage of this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Representative Cameron.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this goes back to Mr. Campbell's comment. I got a little confused. You're supportive of the bill the way it is today, less supportive of the amendments that may be floating around. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, Chair Cameron and members of the committee, I think what Representative Wisnett had mentioned is someone was interested in adding an amendment to the bill. It's an amendment that I don't think has been drafted. It's not related to the substance of the bill we're bringing. It was somebody wanted to add something to the bill, so it's not before you. We understood there was opposition to this mysterious amendment that's not before you. But because it was out there floating around, we thought we'd mention that really what we're after is in the bill that's before you, and that and that we'd love for you to pass it in the form that it's in.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Chief Kennedy, I noticed that in your written testimony you said that there was a concern raised by someone along the way about the limitation of, because there may be other service districts, like the water district, for example, that there may be some language that limited the law enforcement officers employed by a service district established under that statute for the purpose of providing law enforcement services. And I see that that change wasn't made, and I wondered if that's something that is still a concern, or are you planning to add that language, or has that been addressed?
Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, my understanding was there going to be a possibly, there would be a concern about that, and so I added it to the written testimony as an option, an optional change. It's the concern is that the original language might have been too broad, and this would limit the language to only law enforcement districts. So I'd be supportive of that change.
I guess I'll ask Representative Wisnett, is that something that you're planning on working on, or?
Fine, you want to speak to this?
Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mr. DeLashman, you are the, and I apologize, I didn't realize you'd wanted to speak on that last bill, but I did have you down for this one here.
The record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. We're comfortable with the bill moving the way it is right now, and we'll relook at that particular issue about narrowing that scope. I was, for the record, I was the one that actually had raised that question because I thought the original language was broad and could, in fact, allow water districts and some other folks. I do understand the intent of what they're trying to do, and I don't want to slow the bill down. So we'll get it out of here, and we'll take another look at it, and if we need to clarify that particular piece. If I may, on the previous bill, I just wanted to clarify that we were fine with the previous bill as well. I had taken the opportunity when both these bills came up to come up and say, I'm not exactly sure what these bills are doing, but I wanted to reserve the right to look at them and not show up the last minute, and I wanted to let you know that we were fine with the 3445-2. So. Thank you.
That is reassuring, Mr. DeLashman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeLashman, I would like you to see to it that when this goes to the Senate side, you do restrict that, because I don't want the unintended consequences of every little special district deciding they're a cop and starting to enforce traffic laws. I mean, it would be, they'd have to jump through some hoops, but I think we could make it very clear. Besides, I mean, if you just would clear that up, but just really set that in. And I know the Beaverton City had a question about reserve officers. They tried to put that in a different bill that the related clause didn't fit, and so then they were talking about this one. But you could deal with that next door.
And for the record, Mr. Chair, I too have some reservation about adding that amendment that is not here anyway by the City of Beaverton on reserve officers until I see what it actually does. And I also want to make sure that it doesn't slow this bill down, because right. I do understand this bill is important.
And refresh me again. What is it, the amendment we haven't seen from the City of Beaverton? What would that amendment do again?
It, Mr. Chair, was to authorize reserve officers to be able to write tickets, which I believe they already can. They do it other places, and for some reason Beaverton was getting a little gun-shy, so they just thought it would be better if it was clarified in the law, but they, of course, brought in the last minute.
And, Mr. Chair, for the record, the other amendment that we haven't seen, I think that Representative Barker was talking about, is the one that would add the language. It's in the second page of Mr. Kennedy's testimony about limiting the House Bill 3442 to only address special service districts that are providing law enforcement services.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Campbell. With your permission, I believe that the change, in order to address the broadness issue that Representative Bonamici just brought up, I think that all that's required is the addition of two words in front of district, and I want to make sure that's correct. But if it said that a law enforcement officer employed by a law enforcement service district, would that qualify? Maybe that's a question. I'm sorry, Chair McPherson and Council. The really what we're looking at in terms of narrowing this is to clarify that what we're really doing is giving this authority to a law enforcement service district. And I think that the question would be, if it's a very simple fix, as simple as adding the words law enforcement in advance of service district, maybe the committee may want to consider doing that earlier, not later, but we're fine either way. So it's the committee's choice.
Mr. Chair, for the committee's clarification, to expand on what we're doing here, is there's only two. You know, you normally create a service district for water, roads, and we've created a district here for law enforcement. And we did that in Sun River and Black Butte, the only two places. And that's what is a service. It is a law enforcement service district, which is authorized. But the uncertainty about a water district or something could be clarified, I think, by the law enforcement that Mr. Campbell suggested, or the alternative language of Mr. Kennedy, if that's a concern. I tried to look up the two ORS 451s last night, and I couldn't find those. But I think they're just talking about how you go about establishing a service district.
Representative Bonamici.
Procedural question. Can we add two words? Is a conceptual amendment, or are we only
We can suspend our rules and do a conceptual amendment committee, and we're getting down to the point in session where it's appropriate to do that because time is running out on us. So if we feel quite confident of the language that we're using, then we can suspend the rules and do a conceptual amendment if people are comfortable with that. And we've got a lot of work to do now between now and the end of the month, so it may be better to...
Mr. Chairman, we suspend the rules to make a conceptual amendment to House Bill 3442.
Representative Barker has moved that we suspend the rules to do a conceptual amendment on House Bill 3442. Is there any discussion of that motion? Any Representative Comp?
Chair McPherson, I don't like conceptual amendments, and it has nothing to do with this bill. So, just for the record.
Okay. I would...
I will support it this time,
okay, very
believe
good.
It or not.
I appreciate that.
But,
I would say as we're getting down to crunch time, Representative,
yes.
And we may have to do some things we'd rather not do.
Right.
We have a motion in the committee here to suspend the rules to allow conceptual amendment. Any further discussion? Any objection? If not, we have suspended the rules to prepare the conceptual amendment. Could you state the conceptual amendment, Representative Barker?
It would take out the word county on line 6 and say law enforcement.
And service place district. Law
enforcement. Replace the word county.
Chair McPherson and Representative Barker, may I suggest that this is a county law enforcement district. Rather than to take out the word county, just insert the
law enforcement.
County law enforcement district. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
And
actually,
thank you, Chief.
Committee, I'm going to have to redo a couple things here. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3442 and open a work session, House Bill 3442.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules and do what we just did.
Representative Barker moves that we suspend the rules to do a conceptual amendment, and that conceptual amendment will be to insert... the words law enforcement in front of service district and leave county in. Is that the suggestion we have from our
That's
panel?
That's correct.
On line 6.
On line 6 of House Bill 3442. Is there any discussion of that as a combined motion to suspend the rules and to do a conceptual amendment and to adopt a conceptual amendment inserting those two words? Any discussion of that motion? Any objection? Then the House Bill 3442 is conceptually amended by inserting the words law enforcement in front of service district on line 6.
And we don't have emergency on this one either?
No, we don't need it.
Okay. That can wait that long. Okay.
Do I hear a motion on the main bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass to the floor of the due pass recommendation, House Bill 3442 is conceptually amended by the committee, and thank everyone.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 3442 as conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the motion? If not, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3442 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as conceptually amended. And Representative Wisnett, will you carry that one as well?
Sure.
Very good. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3442 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3441.
No doubt.
Counsel.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I first point out this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And what it does is it authorizes courts to impose an additional assessment on persons convicted of specified crimes involving minors. And you should have a list in your packet of what those crimes are. And it also adds to the list of crimes for which a court may enter a judgment of criminal forfeiture. We have a separate list of what those crimes are. It dedicates revenues generated by the assessment and forfeiture to the State Commission on Children and Families account.
Thank you, Counsel. We have first signed up Jan Lee.
This is Wisnett's day. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Honorable Committee members. Thank you for hearing HB 3441 today. I'm proud to sponsor this bill along with Representatives Barker, Flores, and Krieger at the request of the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families, and it's endorsed by the Coalition of County Commissions. HB 3441 makes instrumentationals of specific crimes involving minors subject to criminal forfeiture for proving strategies that promote the healthy development of Oregon's children and families, prevents child abuse, or prevents juvenile delinquency. The bill was modeled after another state. New York is looking at the same bill called Jenna's Law. And a member of our community, Denny Maloney, a national expert on juvenile delinquency, presented this concept to the commission, Deschutes County Commission. I spoke about Denny's sudden death on the House floor the day after he died of apparent heart attack in February. We have experts here to testify on the bill today, including former State Representative Jan Lee and a board member of Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for hearing my testimony on this important bill today.
Very good. Ms. Lee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Jan Lee. I'm a board member of the Deschutes County Commission on Children and Families. And unfortunately, Denny can't be here today to present this case, but what you've seen in the statute is that this would discourage some of the crime trends that are negatively occurring at this point in regard to children, sexual exploitation, child molestation, child pornography, solicitation, and furnishing illegal substances to children and youth. We feel it's appropriate to put this under the seizure statutes because the predators who are perpetrating these crimes actually are using their residences, their computers, their cars, and other assets to be able to enable these crimes. The fund that would be put together as a result of this bill would be the In Harm's Way Fund, and that would allow us to promote programs that are in these areas of concern, such as protection for juveniles, for child abuse programs, etc. There are a number of other programs that are similar to this one. Two of them are the Drug Asset Forfeiture Program that the legislature passed in 2004, and then the Fallen Officers Bill, which actually imposes a fine to provide benefits to those fallen officers' families. In the bill itself, in Section 2, it refers to an assessment of $50. We had originally asked that it be a fine for $100, and that is the only change that we'll be asking for in the bill, that it would be a fine and that it would be $100. As an assessment, it sets up a competitive structure that we want to avoid. In Section 3, this is actually the forfeiture language itself, and I wanted to point out to you particularly that this relates to when a conviction occurs, not before. And you'll see how the assets would be distributed following the current procedures. Under this bill also, the court has the discretion to decide on the assets to be forfeited, and that provides assurances that the families of any of the perpetrators would be protected from a financial means. Section 4 provides that the money goes into the State Commission account, and that no more than 5% of it goes to administration, and you'll see the particular programs that these funds would enhance. You've got some other bills in the committee, House Bill 2843 and 3515. Those make some of these crimes felonies. Our bill is different. It doesn't indicate that the crimes would be felonies, so that it does not add to the cost of prisons and incarceration. I think we owe our children to make them safer, and that's why we're asking your support in passing this bill. And I would certainly be glad to respond to any questions.
Committee, are there any questions?
Chair, Mr. Chair, I have also a Janet, former State Representative Janet Carlson would like to maybe make some comments.
It is Alumni Day
for the House Judiciary Committee.
Commissioner Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 3441. I served on the State Commission on Children and Families when I was a representative here as the House of Representatives appointee to that body. Also served on the Marion County Children and Families Commission, and I've been involved with the commission system since 1991. You may have seen the ribbons on the tree in front of the courthouse, over 11,000 of them. This is Child Abuse Prevention Month. We had 1,558 confirmed cases of child abuse and neglect in Marion County. We did a one-day jail snapshot in July 2005. What we learned is out of 442 inmates, there were 774 children involved. 73% of the people in Marion County jail are parents, 74% meth users, 89% of the women in the jail were meth users. We have focused as a Children and Families Commission system on a strategic plan that has goals, objectives, measurable results to try to address the unintended consequence of the law enforcement crackdown on methamphetamine. So what I'm trying to explain to you is the very good public policy purpose of this bill in terms of increasing revenues for the State Commission on Children and Families for the work that they do. Let me give you an example of a couple things we've done here locally. We learned through a collaborative group that meets every month that children were being pulled out of meth homes in the middle of the night, as many as 5, 6, 7 children, that there was nowhere to put them, that they would go to the child welfare office out on Silverton Road and sit in a cubicle with a welfare worker from 2 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock when offices would open and people could start dialing around and trying to find somewhere to put them. A business leader who serves on our commission heard about this, called together people that he worked with, and raised $200,000 in a 45-minute meeting. 4 months later, we had a receiving home where now children can go for up to 2 weeks, get cleaned up, have nurturing care, and find an appropriate placement for them so that they can keep the siblings together. We also have business leaders and faith leaders on our Commission on Children and Families that sponsored a breakfast 2 years ago, and their goal was to recruit 75 new foster parents. In 8 months, they had 75 new foster homes in Marion County. So the next year, they said, well, now we need 250. And as of this date, at least last week, we were at 118. So this is the kind of work that communities can do when people work together. But we need the support of the public-private partnerships, and the State Commission on Children and Families provides funding the local commissions use for project management, staff support, the kinds of things that make this community work possible. We also support Relief Nurseries, Healthy Start, and court-appointed special advocates, which are all very strong child abuse prevention programs. I did an analysis of the funding. Since 1999, the flexible funds that go to local commissions has been cut by 51%. And so basically we are very low on funding to be able to do this work, although we continue to muddle through. So this bill would be a welcome addition to a revenue source, a sustainable revenue source for the commission. And I just wanted to mention Dennis Maloney, because he served on the precursor of the State Commission on Children and Families, the Children and Youth Services Commission. I met him in 1991 when I was a staff person there. He was an ardent supporter of children and families, big vision, big heart, did a lot of great work for Deschutes County and also for the state of Oregon, and this bill is very fitting for his memory. So thank you.
Good. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Krieger.
Just a reminder, I think everybody's aware, but we have a series of bills coming to us, the dependency package that's already out of the Senate. I think there's 9 bills we passed with a unanimous vote on every one of them. They fit real well what this is doing, enhances it. Good bill.
Any further questions?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. This is truly important work that you're doing. I'm just looking for some confirmation that this is procedurally not going to take money from the victims. We've heard testimony in other hearings about the small percentage of victims who actually receive the restitution they're entitled to, and so I want to make sure that this is a... It looks like it's procedurally different from restitution that goes to victims. Because it's more of a forfeiture, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. In Section 3 of the bill, it lays out that this will follow the standard process for all forfeitures, that first it goes to the costs of the seizing agency, then to the victim, and then the remainder is distributed among these other accounts set by the legislature. And we're just adding a new account to that remainder distribution rather than changing the state formula.
Thank you.
And I also might mention, while I have an opportunity, that I gave you information on Deschutes County that backs up some of the figures that Ms. Carlson was able to share with you as it relates to our county.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you for all your help today with my bills. I did not ask you to move this forward, but there's only one word in the whole bill that... that Mrs. Lee talked about. We want to change assessment to fee, and it'll go to Ways and Means of the committees. Either pass it as, maybe we could pass it as is and work it in Ways and Means, or would the committee want to do another conceptual amendment?
And Representative Wisden, could you point out where that word is?
It's on page 1, line 20.
And also line 8. And, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that they're seeking an increase of the $50 to $100. Is that correct?
Yes.
So it would be an additional change, and that's in line 8.
It's also in section 6 and 3.
Mr. Chair, I would send my request and just ask the committee to pass it as it is, and we'll work it in Ways and Means.
The committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3441 and open a work session on House Bill 3441. And I would say, since this does have a subsequent Ways and Means, and so there's the opportunity to make changes there, and these are this may go a little beyond what we want to do conceptually in this committee, so I would be inclined to leave it as is and to move the bill to Ways and Means so we don't slow down this process.
Mr. Chair, make a motion to refer House Bill 3441 to Ways and Means.
And I would understand, Representative, that would have a due pass recommendation
with
a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Representative Cameron moves House Bill 3441 with a due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion of that motion? Then, if not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Floyd.
Aye.
Representative Huck.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye. Excused.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnitz.
Aye.
Chairman Clifton.
Aye. House Bill 3441 moves from the committee with a due pass recommendation and with referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3441 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2190. And we'll stand at ease for a moment while we get counsel forward.
Thank you.
takes us to House Bill 2190.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2190 is a bill that really you have to look to the amendments, the dash one and the dash three. It's a bill that comes to us from Department of Human Services. On the dash one and dash two, three amendments, excuse me, are to address federal requirements in this area as it relates to foster kids and dependency. What the federal government does is they can't mandate that we do things. They just tell us that if we don't do them, they don't give us money. And we're talking lots of money. The dash one amends the bill, removes the provisions where the legislative assembly makes the election the provisions of 42 U.S.C. 671 are inapplicable to Oregon. This is the abuse reporting. A couple of years ago, we opted out. The federal law says, no, you can't opt out. We're removing this provision, and through regulation, we will tie in to the federal law as it relates to abuse reporting. It doesn't mean we didn't have abuse reporting. We just had our own system. Mickey Cerise is here to testify and with others on behalf of the bill. The dash three require the local citizens review board to make written findings with respect to the Department of Human Services to place children in ward through interstate compacts. It also requires other things concerning what's in the child's record concerning placement and education and other things like that. They are here to be prepared to address both amendments.
Very good. Thank you, Council.
Mr. Chair. Excuse me.
Representative Forrest.
Thank you. Before proceeding now, I note that Council Taylor addressed dash ones and dash threes. However, the staff major summary refers to the dash ones and the dash twos.
That's, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Flores, that's correct. We got the dash three, let's see, I think the day before, I just didn't update it. The dash two, there's just a slight change between the dash two and dash three. They're substantively the same. The dash three was a refinement that came in, I think, early yesterday.
Thank you.
I'm looking for the dash three is here now.
Okay.
Okay. And I beg your pardon. The dash threes supersede the dash twos. They also supersede the dash ones.
No, the one and two threes would have to be adopted. They're separate issues.
Very good. Okay. Mickey Cerise and Harry Gilmore.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services. I work in the division known as Children, Adults, and Families, and that division handles, in part, our child welfare program, and this bill addresses our child welfare program. As Mr. Taylor mentioned, the original bill, House Bill 2190, was a bill that was introduced by the governor at the request of the Department of Human Services. We worked with the governor's office and a number of stakeholders regarding that original concept, and as session began and we continued our work, we began to realize there's much more work we need to do on that particular concept. So we agreed with the governor's office and our community partners not to move that concept forward this session. We also, after session began, became aware that the federal laws that Mr. Taylor referenced earlier that passed in the summer of 2006 require some changes in the Oregon revised statutes. Most of the changes we can handle through administrative rule. However, there are some that needs to be changed in our statutes, and that's what the dash one and dash three amendments propose to do. And Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, to your question on the dash two amendments, there was a technical change on page 10, line 9. Throughout the statute, we had to reference child or ward, and in that one section, we left the term or ward out, and so it was a technical change to get that back in. So we will not be looking at the dash two amendments. Mr. Taylor also referenced that this is tied to some federal funds, and that is true. It involves the funds that come to our foster care program. Those are the Title IV E and Title IV B federal dollars, in Oregon, the total funds to those foster care programs amount to about $250 million. So we are hoping that we will be able to get these through this session. And with the help of Mr. Taylor, we were able to use this bill as a vehicle to do that. And with your permission, I'd like to turn this over now to Mr. Gilmore to talk about the different changes that the two federal laws are asking us to change in Oregon statute. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Gilmore.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Harry Gilmore. I manage the Tactical Assistance Unit at the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families Division. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2190, and as both Council Taylor and Mr. Cerise mentioned, these changes are changes to the federal code dealing with Title IV-E and IV-B funds that were passed by Congress this previous summer and signed into law by President Bush. These are not dramatic changes, however, they are they do change the requirements for state child welfare agencies and juvenile courts when it comes to child welfare services and administering child welfare programs. The changes to ORS 419A.116 and 419B.476, it changed the requirements in this section to require courts and child welfare agencies to consider out-of-state placement when doing permanency planning for children in state custody. And not only do consider out-of-state placement as one of the options for children in state custody, but to also make a finding that an existing out-of-state placement continues to be in the best interest of a child when the case is reviewed in court. These are things that happen in practice currently, but it has not been part of the specifically spelled out in the federal requirements. And so those two changes are made to reflect the changes that were made to the federal code with regard to out-of-state placement. The change to ORS 419A.225, this is a slight change in the wording around court practice in child welfare cases, and it essentially says that courts in different states are required to cooperate with each other and to share information when a case involves a child that is placed by one state in another state, a child in state custody. Again, this is something that happens in practice fairly regularly, but now it's been made a requirement as part of the federal code that state that juvenile courts cooperate and that they share information when it comes to dealing with a child welfare case involving a child that's placed by one state with a resource in another state. The change to ORS 419B.343, this changes again the requirement around juvenile court process when it comes to child welfare cases, and it specifically requires that health and education records be included in the documents that make up the case plan for a child. And more specifically, it requires that current health and education records. There was some language in the previous version of the law that gave a little more latitude in that it said something to the effect that if they're available, they should be included. And now they've tightened up the requirements slightly to say that the most current information when it comes to health and education records must be included as part of the case plan. And so we've made a slight change in we propose a slight change in the ORS to reflect that tightening of the requirement. ORS 419B.443, it increases the federal requirement for visitation of children placed out of state from once annually to once every 6 months. So it says that when a child is placed by a child welfare agency or the court with a resource in another state, that child must be visited a minimum of once every 6 months by either the sending agency or by someone in the receiving state that typically it's a representative of the child welfare agency in that state. Now, in practice, children are typically visited once every 30 days because most states have that requirement for any child that they're serving under their child welfare system. But this sets a minimum standard for children that are placed out of state. And so This is an update to our ORS to reflect that, again, a tightening of the standard. The modification proposed to ORS 419B.449 reflects the federal requirement that out-of-state placements be considered during permanency hearings conducted by the juvenile courts. And again, this is similar to the change to ORS 419A.116 and 419B.476. Again, it's a change to the federal requirements specifically requiring consideration of out-of-state placement. Again, it's something we do in practice, but it hasn't been specifically required by federal code until now. The change to ORS 419B.875, it's a slight change to the requirement for juvenile courts to permit foster parents to participate in a juvenile court proceeding. It changes the wording from previously it said that foster parents had the opportunity, must be afforded the opportunity to participate in a court proceeding involving a child in their care. It's been modified to say that they have a right to participate in the juvenile court proceeding involving a child in their care. And that includes pre-adoptive parents as well, both foster and pre-adoptive. So they've strengthened the language to clarify that they have a right. And the proposed change is to reflect that in our statute. And lastly, the change to ORS 419B.918, it's a clarification in the federal code stating that juvenile courts must allow specific individuals, and it spells out exactly who they're talking about in the law, but that specific individuals have the opportunity to participate in a juvenile court proceeding as a party to the case without having to travel to the state to physically appear in person. It says that the court must allow them to participate by some other means, you know, by telephone or by video conference or by some other means that doesn't require their personal appearance. Again, this is to facilitate the court process around child welfare cases that involve children who are placed out of state and making that process as easy as possible for all involved. That's a summary of what's proposed by the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gilmore. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gilmore. Excuse me. Thank you for going over the section changes. I'd like to go back to the one you reference in ORS 419B.443, requiring the minimum frequency from 12 months to 6 months. And you indicated by the sending agency or the receiving state, but I don't. Could you just clarify for me? Thank you. In the amendments where it's indicated by the sending agency or receiving state, or is that in by reference to the protocol or administrative practice?
Representative Flores, members of the committee, let me just find that portion of the amendment here. I'll just take a
page
second.
Page 9, I think, is where the amendment, pages 8 and 9.
Yes. The wording is that the child or ward has been placed in foster care outside the state, whether the child has been visited not less frequently than every 6 months by a state or private agency. So in saying a state, it gives the latitude for either the sending state or the receiving state.
I see.
Or a lot of states, they will contract, and Oregon does this to some extent, we may contract with a private agency to conduct the home study and to provide supervision, particularly in the case of children who are in pre-adoptive placements. There may be a private adoption agency that's has conducted the home study, approved the home, and they're also providing the supervision in the interim between when the child physically goes to the state and when the adoption finalizes. And so by saying a private agency, it also gives latitude for that private adoption agency or foster care agency, as the case may be, to provide that supervision. Typically, when as a child welfare agency, we place children in a state, we you know, because of the expense and the logistical problems, we typically don't have our caseworkers, you know, traveling to the other state. We can achieve more consistent visitation and more frequent visitation if we rely on the child welfare agency in that state to do so. And that's a reciprocal arrangement between states. When other states place children here, our caseworkers are assigned just like they would be to a normal case, without the court responsibilities, but with the expectation that they'll visit the placement and ensure the child's safety and ensure that the child's needs are being met by the resource family.
Just a quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And so then, as I understand you, that's a practice of the agency, and by virtue of administrative rule, that's all covered and set out, or just simply your standard of practice?
The Interstate Compact for the Placement of Children is the agreement between states that generally governs this area of practice. And the Interstate Compact does not specifically require receiving states to provide that visitation. That may change because a new compact has been proposed, and there is specific wording requiring that in the newly proposed compact. However, that has been universal and accepted practice under the Interstate Compact for the last, to my knowledge, the last 30 years or so, that receiving states, as a reciprocal practice, they will supervise placements. And once they've approved the placement and the child's gone there, it's a given that they'll provide that supervision. The only instance in which that's not absolutely true is if a state places the child in a residential treatment facility in another state, which for our department is a very rare occurrence, because typically if a child requires residential treatment, we rely on in-state resources. But occasionally there may be a child that requires placement in a unique facility that provides a unique service in another state. And in those instances, typically child welfare agencies will not provide supervision because the child's in a staff, 24-hour staff facility. And in those cases, we will have our worker travel to the state periodically to make sure that the placement is still in the best interest of the child and to report back to the juvenile court. Again, this is extremely rare, and in almost virtually all cases, the other state's providing the supervision.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mickey, I'm not sure if this language we have any flexibility with it, but would I be happy with this bill as far as grandparents and family find?
Chair McPherson and Representative Wisnett, we've had a number of conversations around relatives and relative family find. This would not have any impact on that. This does support the federal requirements, though, for the department to seek out relatives, in as much as a relative may be out of state, and this particular federal law that Mr. Gilmore is referencing involves the Interstate Compact placement of children, which are the placements that we make in Oregon to another state, and a lot of the time that is with a relative in another state.
Great. Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for those comments. On page 16, we're talking about the hearing. And is there any way that we could include in there that a grandparent would be able to testify at the proceedings if there's not an active, parent? At the court proceeding? I've been advised by a constituent that a grandparent does not have the right to testify at some of the placement hearings.
Chair McPherson and Representative Wisnett, that would represent a substantive change that's not in the federal law. It's not that we couldn't do that. As you know, we have a number of community partners that work with the Child Welfare Agency. We rarely make an independent decision. We usually get with groups, and because decisions that the department would make is like touching a spider web. It will ripple in places that we're not aware. So we generally meet with our community partners to make those types of substantive changes. What we were hoping to do as an agency with with this particular second step, this particular amendment, was to simply keep it to the federal laws because it does affect the department financially if we can't get these through this particular session.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate those comments. I'll be glad to work with Mickey on the side if it moves out of committee or whatever, and I want to be sure that we could address these. We may want to look if they could help me draft something to be sure that grandparents are included in this, some sort of review, or have the opportunity to speak at the court proceedings in place.
And Chair McPherson and Representative Wisnett, I know Representative Krieger mentioned earlier some bills that are moving through the Senate. Actually, most of them have passed the Senate. And some of those, I think, are getting very close to, if not addressing the concern that you have around relatives, maybe not specifically grandparents, but I do know that is a concern among the group of legislators that are actively working with the department on enhancing and improving the child welfare services in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to reference the fact that one of the bills coming, as I recall, talks about a qualified relative or someone with a caregiver relationship, and they're to be looked at first, and if they qualify, consideration should be given. In my mind, one of the things that came up in all of the dependency cases has always been the grandparents. And I would be, you know, Counselor, if we specifically named relatives, we left it open to all, which of course include grandparents, and maybe we could look at that when we get together.
Thank you. Any further questions?
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2190 and open a work session on House Bill 2190. Representative Flores.
I just want to, for the record, clarify that I know prior to the amendments having been brought forward, we did have a letter from court-appointed special advocates group that dated January 22, now, and they were opposing this bill, but that I'm sure was probably in its prior form. But is there obviously no one here from CASA to address their position on
right,
the now form?
Of course, the substance of the bill has changed entirely with the amendments, and I'm assuming our process being that there's an opportunity for people to come, and if they don't come, as they did before, so they were watching the progress of the bill before, if you have to assume that they are not.
Well, I raised a question just for purposes of having it on record and noting their opposition in the bill in its prior form.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Representative. If there's no further discussion, do I hear a motion on the... Well, remind me, we need both the dash ones and dash threes.
We need both ones and threes.
Yes.
Cool. Ones and threes. Chair members of committee. Excuse me, ones and threes. I'm sorry. I will send the ones and threes down to the Legislative Council's office, and they will combine the two.
Right.
And we'll...
Is there a motion on the dash ones and dash threes?
Mr. Chair, I'll move that the committee accept dash one, dash three into the bill.
Representative Wisnett moves the dash one and dash three amendments into House Bill 2190. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the bill is amended by the dash one and dash three amendments. And I think the subject matter of this would be appropriate to the consent calendar. Does anybody really want to take people from the floor through the issues that are involved in this bill?
Does Representative Krieger have enough background?
We could probably take it to the floor and have a little explanation further of the points. Staff could help us with it. Representative Flores is familiar with it to a degree, and I am. Whatever, I can lead the way on this.
Well, if there's enthusiasm by members of the committee for making a presentation on the floor, I don't want to.
This is not referred to. This is not a referral.
There's no subsequent to
this. Chair members of the committee, considering it's tied to federal funding, I think without it,
Well, there's a compelling need to move this bill to get to the line.
It does not have a fiscal impact.
Some of the issues we discussed, the substantive concerns about parents and grandparents, isn't really the issue of this bill in my mind. It's more that we're getting this in line with the federal law and technically making changes so that we can receive dollars. Those other issues are going to be discussed through this committee in the dependency bills, and I'd be more than willing to put it on the consent counter myself because they are going to be covered, I believe, very, very well in that other package of nine bills.
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest, however, that because of that, those very comments, I think that some brief address of this to our members would probably lay the groundwork for other issues, and noting that this is aligned to continue to receive federal funds. I just think there is enough merit to have just a brief presentation. I don't think it has to go on and on, but I think that it should be addressed.
Well, we need a motion on the bill yet to move the main bill. So do I hear a motion?
2190. Mr. Chair, move 2190 as amended to the floor with the new pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2190 as amended by the -1 and -3 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici. Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cobb.
So the bill moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Krieger, there seems to be some desire for a brief presentation on the floor. We could
we'll co carry it.
But let's have one carrier with brief remarks to explain what's going on. If you would be willing to do that, that would be terrific.
And 20 minutes of questions from somebody.
Thank you, Representative. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2190 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2134.
Jeff. Somebody. You got one person facing your mic?
Yes.
Cool.
Representative question.
Council Kelman's in orientis to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2134 was first heard by this committee on January 19th, and as a work group was formed and the amendments before this committee are the dash ones and twos. I think it's just the dash twos are all the committee's concern right now. And these are, I believe, consensus amendments. The bill deals with electronic interception of communications, and the committee amendments, the dash twos, delete provisions permitting electronic interception orders when officer has probable cause that an individual is about to commit a felony sex offense. The dash two amendments also delete provisions that permitted the warrantless interceptions of oral communications when the officer was in uniform or discloses that he or she is on official duty, or when the officer or supervised person is a party to the communication and there's a substantial risk of death, injury, or sexual assault. The dash two amendments also delete provisions that prohibit courts from suppressing intercepted communications or testimony about the communications. The bill authorizes orders permitting electronic interception when, one, an officer has reasonable suspicion that the person whose communication is to be intercepted is committing, has committed, or is about to commit a crime. Two, there's a substantial risk of death, physical injury, or sexual assault, and the interception is necessary to protect the safety of the person. Three, other investigative procedures have been tried and have failed or are unlikely to succeed. And four, the person suspecting of committing the crime and whose oral communication is to be intercepted, if that person is known, is identified. There's also a sunset provision in the dash twos, and I think the proponents maybe could walk us through it because I only received these about 5 minutes before this hearing, that would make some of these new provisions applicable only for, I think it's 4 years, and then it would go back to the old law.
We have Michael Slauson from the Department of Justice. Mr. Slauson.
Could because I'd like to vote on the budget bill. Thank you.
Mr. Slauson. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice, assigned to the Criminal Justice Division, and in the Organized Crime section. I'm here to testify in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2134. As committee counsel pointed out, we were first here before this committee back in January. Some concerns were raised about some of the provisions in the bill. So we formed a work group to go over some of those concerns. The work group consisted of me from the Department of Justice, Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice, members of the ACLU, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Chiefs of Police in the City of Portland. After spending, I think we had probably three or four meetings and several emails, what we ended up doing was, in sort of a nutshell view of what we did, is we removed any provision that was in the bill that allowed for interception of communications without a court order. So I'll go over the provisions that ended up in the bill with the Dash 2 amendments, but just on a heads up, all of those are going to require a court order. We also did away with the amendments dealing with the exclusionary rule. There were several of those, and we cut all of those out. So what we ended up with was a much sort of narrower bill than what we originally started out with. One of the first thing I guess I'll go over, grab the bill here, talk about what Section 1 does now. It adds the crime of racketeering to the wiretap statute and the bug statute, 133.724. That's the statutory provisions allowing for interception of communications, what typically is known as wiretap or a bug, also known as a spike mic. What that is when a law enforcement officer or somebody under supervision of the officer is not a party to communication and we're seeking to intercept that communication, you have to have a court order to do that, and you have to get a very specific order under Oregon law. You have to have probable cause to believe that the person you're intercepting has committed a crime or is about to commit a crime, or a crime is being committed during the conversation. You have to have probable cause to believe that the conversation that you're intercepting will yield evidence of that crime. You also have to show that the officer has exhausted all other investigative techniques or that they're likely to fail. You have to make that showing to the judge. Once you've jumped over those hurdles, law enforcement has to minimize during the intercept, law enforcement has to minimize the amount of the conversations that they listen to. And what that means is that if they're listening in and the people are discussing something and the communication has nothing to do with the criminal activity, they have to turn it off and then wait. Sometimes it can be 2 minutes. Often what they'll do is maybe listen for 30 seconds, turn it off for 2 minutes, turn it back on. If there's still no criminal activity being discussed, turn it back off for another 2 minutes and turn it back on. That also has to be in the court order and approved by the court. So it's a very high standard for obtaining these orders. That's kind of a background on the wiretap bug. What this would do is to add the crime of racketeering to the list of crimes for which you can obtain that type of order. Racketeering is kind of a unique crime. Usually it comes up with complex criminal investigations when you're looking at criminal enterprises that are engaged in what we've called a pattern of racketeering, which means that they've engaged in a series of criminal activities that are all linked together and linked back to the criminal organization. So you're going to look at, you know, something like a drug trafficking organization or something like that, where you have an organization's sole purpose. It doesn't always have to be the sole purpose of the organization to commit criminal acts, but a drug trafficking organization is a good example where the whole reason for the organization is to engage in the manufacture and distribution of drugs. That is the kind of criminal activity that racketeering is designed to get at, just designed to dismantle that type of operation. Well, so what we're looking to do here with this bill is to add that particular crime to the wiretap, the bug statute. The reason for that is because
these criminal organizations are getting much, much more sophisticated, and it's getting much more difficult for law enforcement to infiltrate the organizations and dismantle them. So some of the techniques that we've seen that they're doing, they're taking counter-surveillance measures themselves. They're working actually in discrete cells, so it's much harder to infiltrate them with an undercover agent. They are only associating with friends and family, known associates, and they're resorting to very extremely violent means of sort of protecting their information. So what we would propose is to add this racketeering in 2134 to allow us to get to that type of activity. Again, we'd only be able to use it if we showed that there was no other investigative techniques that would work. That is what changes in Section 1. Those are that's what came out of our work group that we reached a consensus on. The other change that still in 2134 deals with where we can put the spike mics. The current provisions were a little bit unclear about whether or not we could do it in a public venue, and this came up out of an investigation of a county called our office, wanted to put in a bug at a restaurant where they knew that people who had committed a murder or were planning to commit a murder were going to be. And they had the cooperation of the restaurant, but then they started looking closely at the statute and realized it's not clear that we can do this in a public place. And you look at the statute, it sort of lent itself to different interpretations. And what this does is just clarify that, yes, if you have probable cause to believe that the person is going to be there and be communicating about the crime, that you can do a bug in a public place. The last change that this bill makes deals with those situations we refer to as body wires. And you can get a body wire in Oregon if you have probable cause that somebody has committed a felony or a prostitution offense. And a body wire is something that a law enforcement officer would wear, or somebody undercover acting on the direction of a officer, maybe an informant, we could go into a situation with a body wire. What this bill would do, I think I mentioned that, but so you have to have probable cause that a person committed a felony or a prostitution misdemeanor. What this would do would add a separate provision. It would allow an officer to either undercover or an informant wear a body wire if the officer has reasonable suspicion that a crime is being committed, that the circumstances in which the communication would be intercepted raise safety risks, and pretty serious safety risks, the officer or the person acting under the direction of the officer reads substantial risk of death, serious physical injury, or sexual assault, and also in particular the interception has to be necessary to protect that safety. And finally, you also have to have a showing, much like I mentioned with the wiretaps and the bugs, you have to have a showing that there's all other investigative remedies have been tried or failed. And that's all requires a court order, so that's something that the court has to make findings on. That particular provision has a sunset clause so that in 4 years we can kind of come back and look and see if this is working, if it's not being used, if it's something, you know, we find some cases where it was too narrow. It's pretty narrowly drawn right now. We don't anticipate it happening in a lot of cases. It's just in those cases where the officers could not otherwise develop probable cause, yet you're sending an informant or an undercover officer into a volatile situation, and you want to make sure that for safety purposes it's monitored. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Slauson. Are there any questions for this witness? Could you just remind us who all was on the work group that participated in developing this?
It was the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the ACLU, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Attorney General's Office, the City of Portland, and the Chiefs of Police.
Very good. And I understand this is a consensus product, and I see nodding heads in the back of the room to affirm that. We love those consensus products at this point in the session. Are there any questions for Mr. Slauson? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2134 and open a work session on House Bill 2134.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2134. Any discussion? Any objection? And the dash two amendments are in the bill.
House Bill 2134 as amended to the floor with the due pass, and suggest we put that on the consent.
Seeing a little flinching about
okay.
Consent.
Yeah.
Okay. The motion is to move House Bill 2134 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Not clear. Call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Trigger. Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye.
House Bill 2134 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Bonamici, since you were one of those that objected to going on the consent calendar, would you be willing to carry this?
I will.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session of House Bill 2134. I'm going to reopen the work session of House Bill 2190 for the purpose of moving a suspension of the rules to permit Representative Kump to vote on that bill. Is there any objection? If not, we've suspended the rules to permit Representative Kump to vote on House Bill 2190. How do you vote, Representative
Kump?
She votes aye. I will reclose the work session, House Bill 2190.
Thank you, Chair.
I think this can go very quickly on one more bill here, 2913. I'm going to open the work session on that. Council Calmonson, remind us about this bill.
Okay, very quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill deals with qualified domestic relations orders, which are exceptions to the non-alienation transferability provisions of ERISA, and what the dash ones do is just removes the word qualified from the bill. It used to say that something is a qualified domestic relations order, but that's actually something that a plan administrator has to decide. So it just changes that to domestic relations order instead of qualified domestic relations order. And it, essentially, what this does is allows domestic relations orders from federally recognized Indian tribal governments to be subject to these ERISA provisions, and which would allow them to transfer their benefits in the case of divorce or some other domestic relations order. So,
very good. This is my bill, committee members, and it's an area that I earn my living in when I'm not serving in this building. Therefore, since it's subject matter that's quite familiar to me, I will move the dash one amendments into House Bill 2913. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Then the dash one amendments are in the bill, and I will move House Bill 2913 to the floor with a due pass, as amended, with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll. House Bill 2913. How do you vote on House Bill 2913 as amended?
Vote aye. Thank you.
He votes aye. House Bill 2913 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I would suggest on the consent calendar, unless somebody thinks that needs explanation on the floor. I see.
That was your call.
I think people probably don't want to hear any more about pensions. They've heard in this committee already. Hearing no objection, we'll put that in the consent calendar. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can complete. With apologies to those who attended other items of business, we are adjourned. And we'll